Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good, because I thought I did things in the wrong order, and I might have hung up on you, but apparently I didn't. So Ezekiel J. Craylon from his dusty garret in the wilds, yes, of San Francisco. Is, yes, it in fact dusty there?
No, not lately. Not since we recovered from the fires up north and had all the awful smoke blow down here.
Right. That was Juanita came back from the Dickens Fair one week, and she was having trouble breathing and coughing a lot. And I found out that the smoke from Southern California came up and stayed in San Francisco for like a week.
It's still going on. The air quality is still bad. Been bad for at least a week.
Uh huh. Okay. Yeah, I'm wondering why I'm feeling a little confused about it. Everything is working well. Maybe that's what the problem is. Something is going to have to start going wrong so that I can feel like things are normal again. So you have a couple of Christmas-like stories to read tonight?
Yes, I do. It's for the Christmas hater in us.
The Christmas hater.
It's okay. For all people who love to hate Christmas like I do.
Which is like, what did you say before I put you on the air? That something about Christmas is the real Halloween?
Yeah, for me, Christmas is the real Halloween.
Okay, well, I'll just turn off my microphone and you take it away.
Okay. This first piece is called Frosty the Rabid Snowman, or In Frozen Blood, the first snowman splatter story in literary history. Christmas in Pennsylvania is always bitter cold and white as virgin linen spread across the dinner table of an Amish homestead. The excessive snow is a terrible nuisance to most adults, but to children it is a playland policed by smiling snowmen with button eyes and skinny arms. In the early part of the holiday season, thousands of kids in hundreds of Quaker State towns and suburbs simultaneously roll the icy lint of God's great quilt into legless roly-poly men of snow. These Rubensian parodies stand silent vigil before each picture window blessed by a child's smile, until the first thaw of a false spring, sometime in late February or March, if a big brother doesn't knock them down much sooner, usually the case. However, this story is not about all children and snowmen, nor about some children and snowmen, but about a particular snowman who, one recent winter, terrorized the good citizens of Northwest Pennsylvania with bloodshed and tragedy. By the time Timmy put the finishing touches on his snowman, with poker chips, checkered hunting cap, two lengths of an old vacuum hose, and a Groucho Marx false nose, his L.L. Bean mittens and outer garments of recycled wool were soaking wet, and it was dusk, at which time all over the vast state of Pennsylvania, children just like Timmy stepped into a warm kitchen and left their boots and cinchulate jumpsuits piled in a puddle by the door. Timmy, like all these other kids, ate supper and played Nintendo or Etch-a-Sketch or read the latest Fabulous Four adventure comic book or listened to David Seville and the Chipmunks on a transparent red 33 1/3 RPM or did his homework, unlikely, then peered out the living room window at his new snowman before slipping into bed beneath several layers of Pennsylvania Dutch-style comforters from J.C. Penney's. Shortly after 2 a.m., while he slept the untroubled sleep of the 6-year-old boy, a red light suddenly blinked on the computer console of the control center of a nuclear reactor too near the border of the suburb in which Timmy's family lived. It was a leak, but the reactor shut down so fast and the problem rectified itself so quickly without human intervention that the alarms never sounded and the leak did not flow beyond the yellow zone of the third outer wall of lead casing. It was a brief accident of the lowest priority and cleanup was a simple automated process. Not even so much as 1/1,000,000th of an increase in rats was detected by the Geigers. So the foreman on duty was not required to report this leak to his superiors, only log it in the calendar, then put his feet back on the console and resume snoring. But several radical ions did manage to escape into the atmosphere, and had they just floated into the upper strata instead of being blown by a random breeze onto Timmy's snowman several blocks away, there would be nothing more to tell, and all would still be right with the world and Northwest Pennsylvania. The more advanced the technology, the more it resembles magic, goes the famous quote, or something like that. I can't remember it verbatim, nor can I recall who said it. And this is exactly what happened. Somewhere in the dimension that crosses the border between physics and sorcery, those several radioactive ions, completely harmless in the usual order of things, touched Timmy's snowman and, like the wand of a fairy godmother, brought it to life. But a most unfortunate coincidence turned this miraculous curiosity into a hideous curse, for a rabid dog happened to be pissing on the snowman when it suddenly came alive. As the snowman took its first breath, the mad canine jumped in shock, bit off a chunk of living snow, then ran away. By the time Timmy's snowman learned how to slide around, since it had no legs to walk, it was Christmas Eve, and he was now delirious with psychotic fantasies and frothing at the mouth, not particularly noticeable as the bubbling saliva camouflaged itself quite well around a snow-encrusted mouth and face. The nearest habitat was, of course, that occupied by the presently slumbering Timmy and family. The rabid snowman managed to break in and find the master bedroom. Without a moment's hesitation, he bludgeoned the parents to death with a small Edwardian night table recently purchased at an auction in downtown Philadelphia. This was not an easy thing to do, as the snowman had no hands to speak of, just two uneven lengths of vacuum hose for arms. But he was very strong, very clever, and very mad. He was a cold SOB. Timmy's sister was next. The police discovered some parts of her stuffed in the trash compactor and other parts stuck to her bedroom wall with crazy glue, though her complete remains may never be found. Timmy was awakened by his sister's screams, and he had just enough time to leave a message on his pillow with the Play-Doh he was using to create miniature snowmen. And it said, "It's the snowman!" before the snowman smashed down his door and dragged Timmy from the house. There was also evidence that the snowman tore apart the Christmas tree and destroyed all the presents around the tree before leaving the scene of the crime. Timmy's body was never found until April, when the snow thawed and a Mennonite farmer was plowing up his field for the first planting. Naturally, Timmy's message made no sense to the police, until reports started coming in about a man disguised as a snowman lurking the streets at night and breaking into houses. Some witnesses with binoculars claimed to have seen saliva frothing from the suspect's mouth as he suddenly turned and glared in their direction. Needless to say, many folks believing in Bigfoot and or UFO abductions had a field day with the media and were the center of attention at American Legion and John Birch Society events. After several more families were brutally killed in three counties across northwest Pennsylvania, the police realized they had a serial killer on their hands, now dubbed the Rabid Snowman. He was never caught, and the homicides continued until, by March, over 25 families and Christmas trees with their attendant gifts had been wiped out. Suddenly, it was spring. The snows thawed, and the murders stopped forever. The case of the rabid snowman remains unsolved, as the only evidence of the suspect is circumstantial. In a vacant lot in one of the formerly terrorized suburbs, a little girl playing hopscotch found the following items in a clump of weeds: 5 poker chips, a red and black checkered hunting cap, two long pieces of an old Kirby vacuum hose, a false nose with eyeglasses and a mustache, and one L.L. Bean mitten with a piece of orange Play-Doh stuck in the fabric. All these items, except the last, matched the neighbor's description of Timmy's snowman. And thanks to a revealing speck of Play-Doh in the shape of an eye, or as some investigators suggest, part of an exclamation point, the mitten was identified beyond question as having once belonged to our tiny Timmy. God rest his soul. All right, now, my next story is called Jesus on the Oprah Winfrey Show, or I Can't Believe It's Not Beelzebub. Jesus Christ returns to planet Earth, and, of course, he is invited to a lot of talk shows. In order for us to understand better what this man called Jesus is really all about. So it is on the Oprah Winfrey Show he has asked the question, Jesus, what do you think was the most important advice you ever received in your lifetime as the suffering Messiah? Jesus deliberates on this a few moments before answering, Well, Oprah, I don't consider my incarnation as the Messiah among the most relevant of my past life experiences. Even so, during that existence, I received so many excellent words of wisdom that I really can't pick a favorite. But I'll tell you this, I shall never forget the worst piece of advice anyone gave me in any of my multitudinous lives. Oprah Winfrey leans forward in profound curiosity and says, Okay, Jesus, and what was that? Jesus finally answers, Well, it was during my present incarnation, as you now see me. And it came from a psychiatrist who once told me, Jesus, you can't save the world. Oprah parries, That revelation must have been quite a shockeroony to you old eagle there, buddy. Touche, Oprah, retorts Jesus, lighting a Camel Light 100 to soothe his jingled nerves. Touche. Mea culpa, Oprah chuckles. It's always fun to play devil's advocate with you, Jesus. Fine with me, Oprah, grins our savior, as long as you don't mind an occasional dip in the lake of fire. Well, another burning question I have, audience guffaws, before Oprah continues, regards the human side of Jesus Christ. Besides tobacco, do you have any other addictions? Jesus blushes and lowers his head. Yes, one other. Boys. In that way, I'm like my daddy. Suddenly, a voice booms out of nowhere. Allah, the old Arab, says I'd walk a mile for a camel, two for a sheep or goat, and three for a boy. Ha, ha. Oprah Winfrey raises her eyes to the ceiling and, slightly disgruntled, challenges our holy guest. Can't you ever get your father to show up in person? Jesus shrugs his shoulders. God knows I've been trying, but he seems to take everything like one big fat joke. You know, I can't even get him to see me whenever I want. Wait a minute. Oprah grows serious. You mean to tell me you still can't be with your father? Well, not quite. Ponders the Son of Man. It's just that he sees me whenever he wants, but I don't get to see him whenever I want. It's just not fair. Oko drops a pensive arm from her chin and says, sadly, No, Jesus, that isn't fair at all. Hey, Jesus, I got two front row tickets to see Jesus Christ Super Stud tonight. Wanna go? Our man of the cross sighs and flips a rude finger to the sky. Fuck you, Dad. Just fuck you. Okay, guy, be that way. I got plenty of hot cherubs who are dying for a date with Big Dick. Oprah, in raging fury, jumps onto her chair and waves an angry fist at the ceiling. God, don't you think you're going a little too far? Think of your wonderful son. I always think of my son. Last night when I was humping Lucifer, I thought of my son. Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus! Don't talk to him, Oprah, grumbles Jesus. Just don't talk to him. It's the only way you'll get him to leave us alone. Hands shaking, our Lord attempts to light another cigarette, but drops the matchbook. "Here, Jesus, have an archangel. I'm done with him for a while. Maybe he'll get you off the raggy." Out of nowhere appears an incredibly gorgeous dude adorned in nothing more than a bulging gold lamé loincloth and these opalescent, feathery white wings stretching across the entire breadth of the stage. He alights by Jesus, who caresses the firm, smooth butt of the archangel, then grabs his own ample crotch and says, "Okra, I hate to break this off, but as you can see, it's meant to stay on and be fondled." And with these words, the archangel's fat crown pops his head above the loincloth. Camera zooms in for a yummy close-up. Audience drools in raptured silence as a milky substance dribbles from the crown and down the angel's spear. When the camera regretfully pulls back, this glorious angel tosses his luxurious mane of silver hair and laughs, "Meet big dick, ha ha." Then he lifts Jesus up, cradles him in his massive arms, and looks straight into the camera. "I love my son more than anyone else in the universe. Let's go, Jesus. You got a date with me, always." They vanish, leaving Okra Winfrey behind, along with a half-empty pack of Camel Light 100s lying on the floor beside the empty chair. The end.
How long ago did you write that?
Quite a while back. It says 08, but that's when I added it to my blog. It must have been around 1988, 1989, because it's part of my, it was one of the early stories from my collection called Parables for the 21st Century.
That was before you came to live in California.
No, I've been here since 73 in San Francisco, and then a three-year hiatus in Santa Cruz County from 80 to 83, then back up here.
I've been
here a long time.
And then the East Coast for the man who tried to kill himself.
Huh?
The East Coast. There was your friend who tried to kill himself but didn't...
I met him in San Francisco. He got here about 2 years before I did, and then he left in Christmas holiday in 1984, Randolph Lewis Taylor, yeah.
Did he end up living much longer than that? Because I don't remember you talking about him after that.
Well, he had survived the shooting. Our contact was sporadic, but I wrote to him every month and so forth. And then he came to hate me, whatever. Well, you know, someone who's been through war and those horrors can't be very mentally stable. Not everyone can pull out of that. So I did not let that really. It was difficult and painful, but I made sure I was here for him. And then lost contact with him. Last thing I heard from him was in 1992. He sent me a Christmas card. And may the spirit of Christmas be with you always, it said. And there was a picture of the manger with the animals around it. Hmm. Very modern style little painting. And all it said was Randolph. And it was return address was from a hospital here in San Francisco. I called the hospital. There wasn't anyone by that name, but I think he told them not to tell anyone. And No, I got it confused with another mysterious letter. No, that was the last thing I heard from him. And then as the years went by, it was hard to... I couldn't find anything on the internet. Every year or so, or twice a year, I would look up and search the name and see if anything would come up. About 8 years later, something did come up. It's from the Washington Post. And supposedly he had died of AIDS. And he was quoted as... And he had these people would bring a couple of dogs, two people dying of AIDS, you know, for company. And he would have these two Cocker Spaniels, and he said, "These dogs love me more than any person ever has." I felt like that he reached out to me through the art of it, just smacked me in the face. He said, "You motherfucker."
Yeah.
I said, "Oh, my God."
He wasn't, you know, I don't like, think he was doing that to you. He probably wasn't.
Well, that's how it felt. No, I'm laughing at that. No, it was like even beyond the grave, he had a he could twist a knife in my back. No, of course not. But that's, you know, the last thing I heard about it was he said that. I said, but gee, I was there for a long time. No, I think it's funny now, you know, and so forth. He came to me and, well, you know, I thought he had died before he did, before 1992. It was around 1988 or so. I had taken one of my walks to the city towards downtown, and it was my habit then to go to City Hall because they had a restroom down there. And this is before they had the metal detectors. I don't go to buildings that have metal detectors. I hate that stuff. So I went in there, and there were these wall hangings all around of people who died of AIDS who were police from the SFPD. And one of them said, Randy Taylor. And he was a cop, you see. I thought, oh, my God. So, you know, I broke down and cried. I went home, got my camera, came back, took pictures of it, you know, put it up. And then I tried to find out from the police department if this was my Randolph, because it said Randy, not Randolph, you know. And they couldn't tell me. But I had to fill out a form. The family would give me permission, whatever. Turned out it was another Randy. He was a black dude. And then it was like a premonition or something. But he came to me in a dream. So more than once, several times after that, while I was in, well, before I found out it wasn't my Randolph, I was in grief. You know, grief went on for a couple of years. And then he came to me in a dream, and he said that he's my guardian angel, and that he didn't die, and he didn't even go to Vietnam. It was all an act he set up for me to put me on an adventure. And I said, and he asked me, "Are you upset that I?"
What do you mean he didn't even go to Vietnam? Wasn't he a veteran?
Well, he said he's a guardian angel, so you know.
Well, wait. This is, you're talking about what happened in your dream.
Yes.
Okay.
And he said, you upset that I trick you like that? I said, no, actually, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a brilliant plot to, you know, make me a hero, give me a chance to put me on an odyssey, and that no one was really hurt. It was all an act or stage. And I asked him how you do this. He said, well, we have a ways, but I can't tell you. I mean, I think you can figure it out. And
it's said, a software. It's an app. You buy it from the Google store. It runs on your phone.
Well, he said, I didn't think you would have a chance to go out to D.C. And when you did, I had the implant.
Had to make something
fake,
up. Okay.
A fake bullet in my shoulder blade.
Oh, my God.
I got to touch the bullet lodged in the shoulder blade before they removed it.
That's a pretty elaborate practical joke to pull on somebody.
Well, you know how I got to go out there? I had another dream. I wanted to fly out there after he shot himself, right, and stand by his side. So I went to, by then I had some clout. I was a founding member of Mobilization Against AIDS, and I went to different gay groups seeking the money to go out there and stand by his side for a week, because he's also gay, right? Well, it was very popular back then to hate Vietnam veterans, so I didn't get any help there. So then I went to Swords to Plowshares and other veterans groups, and back then it was very popular to hate homosexuals, so I didn't get any money there. I didn't know how. I had just walked out of the last real job I had. It was for PC World. Oh, that was a nightmare. That's a whole other story in itself.
PC World Magazine?
Yes.
Huh.
Yes. I got to lay my hands on the original Macintosh before the public did. But anyways, because they also printed Macworld. They were the first to do something on the magazine on the Macintosh. Anyway, so I didn't have any money. I was back on disability. I didn't have any money to go there, right? Well, I had a few months before that, I had, let's say, a couple of friends to keep from being homeless, a couple stay in my room. I had an extra bed. For 1 week, they got a new rental, right? And they left after a week. Well, I had another friend who was on welfare, poorer than me, and I took him out. He was a really nice guy, Mark Coriel. He has long ago died. that's a sad story. Oh, we have some funny stories, too. But when we came back to my room, the door was unlocked, and I pushed. I said, I don't remember not locking the door. Do you notice that? He said, no, I don't know. I thought, wait a minute. So I pull out my ladder and climb up in my loft. My first computer, my compact luggable, was up there. It was gone. So I figured out, oh, they must have made a copy of the key and stolen it. Well, I had it insured, but I didn't think I would get any money for it because it was just a room and they might redline or whatever when I had to fill it. But I had to call the police and report it. So a cop came and said, it doesn't look like it was broken into. I said, well, it was stolen, and I swear I locked the door. Could you just file the report? It's okay. And I sent the police report to the insurance company. All right, and I forgot about it. So months passed. And as those months passed, you know, Randolph shot himself, and I tried to fly out there. And then I had this dream where I was way up in the stratosphere looking down on the Earth, and all circling the globe was me and millions of thousands of other angels all joining hands. And they told me, you know, telepathically, they said, you're doing very well so far, Gene. That was my name back then, my birth name, Gene Catalano. So, but you need to fly out there, or he'll die. You need to be stand by side, he'll die. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to get the money. I said, don't worry, it will come to you. It will come to you. Don't worry, it will come to you. And so, you know, I tried to get the money, go to the gay groups and Venice groups, and nothing happened. And then about a month and a half later or so, the check comes in. I know it was about $2,200, which is plenty of money back then, 1985, for me to fly out there.
Right, computers cost a fortune back then.
And they were heavy as hell.
They were, yeah, but $2,200 in the early 90s is like $4,000 now.
Yeah. So the thing is, I was so angry at him for stealing it, and now I was so happy. And it was a dream that told me the money would come in, and I totally bought it. I never counted on that insurance money. I never thought of that, but I just thought I.
Why does it take so long for them? I mean, you file a report, you file the claim. Why does it take months for them to give you the money for whatever was stolen? Because you pay them on time, or they cancel your coverage.
Well, doesn't that happen to a lot of people?
Yeah, but I don't understand why that happens.
People waiting after a hurricane to get any help.
Oh, well, that's different. That's a hurricane. That's not a somebody. That's an act of God.
Well, I only had to wait like 3 or 4 months. They have to wait 3 or 4 years.
So. If they get anything at all. You know, they're still, I understand, there's still native people in Alaska waiting to get their payoff from the Exxon Valdez. And that was that long ago.
Well, so then later on, you know, Randolph told me he didn't die. He faked it all. And those dreams and other things that happened since then gave me these ideas for a different kind of philosophy. And, well, it was based on the Buddhists, we have no enemies, only teachers. You know, what's really going on. And it made me consider that all these things that we think are really happening in the world aren't. They may not even, in other words, for example, among many countless examples, would be maybe there isn't any war going on anywhere in the world, and it's all an illusion. And how can this illusion, I mean, I don't want to get talking to angels in a Christian sense or whatever, but hypothesize maybe they can, you could say, well, if they have all this power, they can create illusions anyway, even one angel, whatever. But maybe there's only 1 billion people on the planet, and there's 6+ billion others. They're all angels, and that's one way they can control the media and make illusions and do all this stuff so that we can learn our lessons, think these things are going on, but they really aren't. So no human being really has to suffer to that extreme. But I also had a vision of Odin came to me, over Randolph Keller. Now I'm not into the Nordic gods. I don't study them. I was shocked, and I just met this guy just before I had this vision. This guy spoke with a thick German accent. I was reading some of my poetry out on the Harvey Milk Plaza, and people really liked it. It was really good. And he came up to me, has thick German accent, and said, "You're really good. You know, you're not gay like these other guys around here. You're brave." And he had his arm around me. He was a strong, tall, young man.
Did he have both his eyes?
Pardon?
Did he have both his eyes?
Both his eyes?
Yeah, because Odin only has one eye.
Yes, I know, I know. I was also beginning that day and for a week, I was beginning to have these problems with my left eye. yes, this is interesting, and it ties in with what I'm about to tell you.
Okay,
so
all right.
He had his arm around my neck, and he could have broken my neck, and he says, I'm a skinhead. And then ironically, this gay guy walked by and mumbled in his breath at me, faggot, and he said, do you want me to beat him up? I said, no, that's fine. And he said, I'd like to meet you again. I got to go. Can I have your phone number? He handed me a pen and put out his arm, and I wrote the phone number in his forearm. My phone number is forearm. But he really complimented me. Whatever. It was very interesting. And then I go home. I got stoned out of my skull and some good pot. I'm sitting there. All of a sudden, I had a vision. It was Odin had come to me and said, we hear your prayers for the gay community, and they will be answered. He said, we are the first gods. You know, we are the gods of the Ice Age, from the Neanderthals, the gods of the ice and snow. We gave birth to all the other gods that followed. We are the strongest, and we will avenge you. And then they showed me a future of an Ice Age, only soon to happen, only... By the time it happened, the world was already in peace, and it was a beautiful world with ice sculptures and stuff, and how people got along. And it was, as you can imagine, a world in peace. An ice age can be a wonderful adventure because everybody works together and there's all this love and so on. And then he showed me how he said, your prayers for Randolph will be answered too, because he was one of those veterans who's seen and participated in the worst of war, killing all that stuff, and some of these people can never forgive themselves. They can, their whole life is just suffering, and they just can never realize, they can never accept that they were young and foolish then, and they're different now, and they could, separate the two and get over it. He never could. And he said the only way he will get over this is to be shown, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that these people weren't killed, that their souls were taken away into, heaven or a better place or nicer dimension, well before these things happened, and angels entered their bodies to replace their souls to act out the horrors and the death throes so that...
Oh, wouldn't that be nice if that were true? That would be something.
Other humans,
but I'm afraid it's not.
I'm not interested in debating it. I'm interested.
I'm not debating it. I'm just thinking. Wouldn't that be nice? Like in Dead Like Me.
Of course. It would be. But it's quite a legitimate conclusion, philosophy, actually. So that these people, other people on the outside, can see these death throes and thinks it's really happened. But the only way Randolph would be healed of that would be absolutely convinced, not brainwashed, but shown, before you actually did these things, no harm was actually done. And then he showed me like a spirit standing beside the different soldiers there. Like I too was an angel. They said it's how Odin showed me how my caring did this, and they gave me the key or the understanding of what the Buddha meant by saying we have no enemies, only teachers. And so when you apply this idea to other things, maybe World War II really didn't happen. It was, in other words, another grand act and so forth, and that we are, it's one of life's big secrets, and we don't understand or realize that. And when I've discussed it with different people, some people are very outraged and said, oh, that's ridiculous, and yet these people, like Christians, believe that God is love, yet believe God can actually allows people to suffer to that extreme. Well, if God is loving, he can't do that. He doesn't do that. So what is the workaround? He's an actor. He's a Cecil B. DeMille. He's a drama queen. He creates these incredible dramas, make us think these things really happen. And if I'm correct, we will have a whole reinterpretation of human history from the very beginning. And there's also quite a lot of humor in that, too. Now, that also makes me a revisionist of the Holocaust, and I've been knocked out of Usenet groups for that, suggesting, they say, well, that trivializes the Jewish tragedy. Well, history. I said, no,
I,
it doesn't.
I hear that. Okay.
Yeah. Let's just say there was a heaven. You go to heaven. You're back with your friends who are Jewish, and you believe that they suffered this horrible thing in the concentration camp. Well, is that heaven, if you have that in the back of your mind, whenever you think of them, whenever you see them? No, there's that little bit of hell going on inside you. But if you realized, they say, well, listen, my friend, that didn't happen. My soul was taken away. And people were asking me questions. It was big in Usenet groups, that discussion for a while. Someone said, well, what about those who claim to be survivors? I said, well, they had a pact with the angels, and they gave them the story to tell and not tell the truth. And they were fine with that because they were delighted to see. Now, if you had someone who, if you go to heaven, you're with someone, you have a returned to a friend who suffered a Holocaust or suffered some other horror tragedy, that is not heaven in your mind. If you sincerely believe they actually had this terrible suffering, it's still a bit of hell going on. But if you saw, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that that didn't really happen,
okay,
then that's happened.
I'm sorry. So, I'm becoming bleary at this point and losing the thrust of your argument because I'm getting tired of talking on the phone. So I'm not trying to tell you that there's anything wrong with what you're saying. I'm just not capable of paying attention to it anymore. I need to either go forward or go to sleep. I'm doing the best I can here, just to let you know.
The point is, when these people get upset, they would rather have a God that is violent and sadistic.
Yeah, but
still calling
just,
him love.
But you understand. You understand that I don't believe in any of that.
Of course not. You're entitled to. And they'd rather believe. But those who believe in God rather believe that He does allow and commit this violence committed when there is an alternative to it.
No, it's just as that your philosophy is just as viable as anybody else's on the subject
of
supernatural happenings and persons and various political interactions between them, because that the entire thing is imaginary from my point of view.
Right, but for those who want to believe in a God, I give an excellent option along with the others.
Well, that's a good. Have you got? Is this part of your book?
Somewhat, yes. Some of it's in there, yes.
All right, okay. Well,
the point is expressed in some of my chapters, yes.
If it isn't too much trouble, will you send me a link to the part of your book that's published that's on the web? Is all of it on the web?
Yeah.
Well,
but I have other various essays where I discuss this in different ways.
Send me a link to something that runs this down for me so that I can read it later when I can pay attention to it.
Yeah, well, I'll my vision of Odin I wrote down. I'll send that to you. I'll send you the link.
A vision appeared of a holy angel.
Vision of Odin. And I was having problems with my left eye. It turned out to be a central cerebral retinopathy.
Well, see, there's that. There's that.
Yeah, and that was around. And see, when I had the vision of Odin, I did research on Odin, and that's when I learned about his left eye. I said, "Oh my God, I'm having problems with my left eye," and I had an appointment to see the doctor the next day.
You might like a book by Neil Gaiman called American Gods. They made a TV series out of it this last year.
Yes, I saw a few.
Episodes of
it.
That. Yeah, well, it, the book is better, just to let you know. The TV show goes off on a weird tangent. The book is rather magical. Everything Neil Gaiman writes is golden, as far as I'm concerned. Uh-huh. But you might get a kick out of American Gods. But okay, I'm going to put on some music and then read some more stories. And thank you for calling and reading your story and telling me all about this other interpretation of life, the universe, and everything that might make people feel a little better about the suffering that they feel that they have caused.
Well, it has been taught by other sages. I just have I bring it up to modern times.
Terence McKenna, for example. There are no angels, only machine elves.
He believes in unicorns and stuff like that, but he's not into the mundane New Age stuff, which doesn't. He says that they don't go anywhere with it. They don't go into depth and analyze it and research.
Well, I like listening to his stories, and so does everyone in the audiences at the places where he records. Look up I know about it, but I'm telling people to go to YouTube and look up Terence McKenna. You'll find that.
Oh God, he's wonderful.
People have recorded just about every word he ever said in front of an audience, and they practice some. Cutting it up and making little videos out of it with psychedelic accoutrements attached to it, and echoes and music, and making it a lot more grandiose than it is. He's just a weird little guy with a funny story about drugs that
he
tells very well.
He has incredible sense of humor.
He sure does.
I mean, oh,
Terrence McKenna, M-C-K-E-N-N-A. Thanks for calling, Ezekiel J. Kralin, and send me a story, and I'll read it next week on the show.
Okay, you're spoiling me. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.